Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. As you know, this is our final seminar. First, thank you for the kind words and the comments that you've sent. I want to address a couple of comments at the beginning, but ask you if there are other questions or clarifications that you have from what we've discussed before, or if there's something we haven't discussed before that you'd like to add to the hopper at our discussion, either before or at the end of this seminar. I wanted to begin with, and this is open mic, so if anybody has anything to add or ask, go for it now. Anyone have any questions or clarifications or things you'd like to be sure that we discuss in this final seminar? Well, one application of this, of your addressing your money story so that you can be listening for and finding ways to facilitate developing your client's money story, if that's a coaching issue, is one of being sure that you charge what you're worth. Because price provides a context of value. And often with something like coaching, there are not the kind of industry standards or givens that there are in other professions. So you'll see a wide range of variability. And here's one study that I think has been very helpful for me to look at and to share with people who have trained with me. The Wharton School of Business did a study to survey several thousand professionals of various persuasions, docs, dentists, attorneys, financial professionals, to determine what would cause someone to sign on for their professional services and what would cause someone to stay away, to not sign on for their professional services. And they looked at a number of variables, including reputation, years of experience, referrals, kind words said about, various kinds of training, degrees, credentials. But they found the one thing that caused someone to sign on, more so than all the credentials and the reputation and years of experience and the amount of the fee and the state of the economy. The same thing that caused someone to sign on was the same thing that caused someone to decline their services if it went the other direction. And that was the clarity and the confidence of the recommendation of the professional for their services and the statement of the fee, because clarity and confidence really captured the essence of confidence, and that's what people buy, especially in an area that you don't exactly know what's going to happen when you're engaged with a professional, like professional coaching, but the clarity and the confidence of the professional can make a huge difference. Think about the last time you went to see, let's say, a physician for the first time, when that physician gave you a clear understanding and with confidence, you probably signed on. The opposite would be you probably were out of there or should have been. So that's important. So getting in state, being clear, confident, specific, when you do the recommendation, like at the end of a sample session, if you do it that way, can provide a significant value to you and the engagement with a client. One other thing in terms of the questions or comments sent in, I want to ask you this question based on a couple of comments from those of you who've sent them in. What do you think the most common money mistake that we make would be? Think about, across the board, the most common money mistake. One major consideration is not to consider opportunity cost. That means the things that we lose, that we give away now or later in order to do something now. So opportunity lost is something we don't usually consider. The accounts of behavioral economists and neuroeconomists, it's the most common money mistake we make. So this means that when we spend money on one thing, we can't spend it on something else. Here's just a really simple example. You have a dollar, and you're in front of a choice of an apple for $1 or an orange for $1. The opportunity is to buy one. The opportunity cost is you won't be able to have the other. So we give up an opportunity that the dollar provides now or in the future when we make a choice on another specific item. Let's make it a little more complicated. Let's say you have $500 each week beginning on Monday. That's all you can spend. No going into debt, no other income, no begging or borrowing, $500. The beginning of the week, you may not consider what you're giving up later in the week by having dinner and a drink. And you may buy a fairly expensive shirt. By Friday, you're looking at the whole weekend ahead, you got $42 left. The tough choices left on Sunday would be either to buy a newspaper or a bagel with the remaining money, and just to remember the dinner, drink, and shirt on Monday. So on Monday, there was an opportunity cost to consider, but it really wasn't clear. You maybe not thought about it. It wasn't in the foreground of thought of conscious choice or decision. Sunday, the opportunity cost is finally clear, but it's too late. You're going with the times or with the bagel. So opportunity costs may be something that we can think about as we make financial decisions. And what this means is the biggest money mistake is we don't think about it as conscious choice. We don't consider our money as a closed system, a finite resource where one choice affects another. So just some things to think about. And thanks for the prompts and the questions that you sent in. Anything else anyone wants to add while we have a discussion mode here? Well, I'm going to go to the lecture mode so that you don't have to worry about background noise. I'll come back if you have any questions or comments or clarifications at the end. We're going to look at the final two steps in the roadmap system to look at how we can understand a money story. Step six is about putting all of this into action to create new experience, to author new experiences. Now, our stories, remember, are not something we think of as a story. A client is not going to think of what they're doing as their story. It's just the way things are. So this is our metaphor to organize things. But we trust our stories. They're our reality. When our stories and our behaviors don't fit, there's a kind of disharmony. We have to change one or the other to restore harmony. Sometimes we revise our stories. Sometimes we just change the way we see reality. Now, we've considered if your story doesn't allow you to do certain things. If your story is that you're a procrastinator, it will disallow you from finishing early. If your story says you don't do technology well, you'll live out this assumption. So let's look, especially with the backdrop here of considering your money story, let's look at the dynamics of change itself. Because first, usually, the idea of change will create some anticipation or excitement. Then, when it's on the cusp of action, it's maybe anxiety or trepidation. Then, with engaging the experience, expansion, and finally, mastery. But now, here are a couple of additional aspects of change that may seem paradoxical, and think about these aspects of change as you're facilitating an evolving new story with your client. Every step forward means relinquishing a past position. In other words, someone must mourn. They must say goodbye, emotionally as well as practically, to a familiar, maybe long-held, and practice old story. This is a process. It's a developmental step, not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it and change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend to give up a habit or a pattern of behavior or an identity or maybe just the hope that by getting the old story just right, finally, and doing it better, it's going to work. No matter how maladaptive that old story still has to be mourned. And the second aspect, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change, is an injury to self-esteem. Now, this seems paradoxical. This carefully crafted old story, even with some aspects of identity attached, is replaced by something better. And you have to contend with, I could have been doing better all along. Why didn't I do that? Why didn't I recognize it? That is not a useful place to place energy, as you know from mentor coaching clients who may do that. So I think there are some components to this dynamic of change that might help to consider. These are sort of internal conceptual markers. These are, again, for us developing a way of thinking about this as coach. One, the myth that there really is a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice is there and it'll solve all the problems. The disappointment, and you hear how this is kind of an evolution. The disappointment that nothing's perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness in adulthood. The development, the recognition, nobody's going to take care of it for you. Also, the scientific term for that is adulthood. The growth to take the next best action. And finally, a kind of consolidation, a happy, sad experience that results. Happy about the mastery, the autonomy of moving ahead, the effectiveness of not constructing an obstacle, and sad about mourning an old story. So these are all things to consider. Now, let's apply a more focused aspect here. I want to look just at the idea of some financial mistakes, how the unconscious operating system can manifest in various financial mistakes. You'll see a listing, I think, they're either 25 or 27, I have in the resource guide for you, just the definition, and listed there so that you can sort of recognize it when you hear it with clients. But I want to elaborate on a couple for each of the three categories. There are some biases that are emotionally based. So this is the ABCs, the affect, the feeling, the behavior, the cognition. So these are some emotionally based biases. One is nostalgia bias. We feel more nostalgic at difficult times because nostalgia remembers things not as they were, but as they wish them to be. Sort of like airbrushed memories backlit by idealization, because nostalgia recalls the ideal rather than the real. Now, has anyone ever gotten worse in high school and college sports as the years go by, or become less popular in memory replays? Marketing taps into nostalgic experiences. It's easier and faster to associate with idealized memory that can create a way station to a new product identification. Think about how advertising appeals to that. The nostalgic trigger is overlaid with new information. This coupling uses nostalgia to influence current choice. Arnold Palmer and that old tractor. Two classics preserved by one particular motor oil. You've probably seen a replay of that from some time ago. Another is invincibility bias. This is when there's a sense of immortality or simply of denial that we all had when we were young, but there's still some whispers in adulthood. For example, 19% of the population believe they're in the upper 1% of income. 90% of all drivers believe they're above average. 75% of people believe they're healthier than average. And just think about the tech rally investors in the late 1990s or the bubble bursting in 2008. Think about the various ways that this can affect money, investment, savings. A couple of examples of behavioral biases. One is transference fallacy. In psychoanalysis, the tendency to activate feelings and associations from a past context to a current one is considered a type of transference. In other words, using old software to perceive and process a current situation. An example, Digital Equipment Corporation posted a 13% decline. Hewlett-Packard collapsed one half of its value that same day. Totally unrelated, totally not related to Hewlett-Packard's spreadsheet or value, but they just happened to be in the same industry, and there began to be a computer sell-off. Spending justification. In other words, creating a just cause to spend. Someone takes money from retirement savings to spend with a justification of an immediate need being greater than the abstract future need of retirement. So the question may be addressed by how will you repay it? Because there's an internal bargaining to say, well, I'll repay it next week or next paycheck or next month. And it can be dismissed with a vow to return the money at some future point, which is not a plan. Another, status quo bias. Resistance to leaving a comfort zone. This is another word for inertia. The default option is to stay in a comfort zone. Here's an example. Marketers know when they give a free 3-month trial, the inclination for a subscription for a magazine, let's say, the inclination is to stay with the familiar and not initiate the cancellation. 75 to 80% of these initial free subscribers stay on for the long haul of paid subscription. Only 62 to 68% of those who stay actually read the subscription. So this is something that we need to be aware of, that our natural inclination is to maintain the status quo, to sustain inertia, because it's work to initiate a new order of things. And remember the example about the automatic enrollment savings program for retirement for companies that offer an initial opt-in, making a decision, they get 20% enrollment. If it's automatic and somebody has to initiate opting out, it's almost 100% that they stay in. Cognitive biases. We have an inclination to bring closure to something. Diagnosis bias is one of those. To label a person or situation and then seek data to confirm more vigorously, coupled with blindness to evidence that may contradict. Here's a good illustration of that. Two economists, Barry Stahl and Ha Huang, had studied skill categories and stats of NBA players. They distilled these stats into distinct skill measuring categories over 5 years, scoring, quickness, toughness, and then they looked at all the variables that determined playing time in games, skill categories, the player's performance, injury or trade status, but there was one variable that had greater impact than any of these actual performance data. It was the player's draft selection order. Draft order more highly correlated with playing time through the first 5 years in the NBA, which was as long as they studied these stats. So even though skill and performance determines a draft order, once picked, coaches and managers should only be interested in the player's performance. In other words, once the draft is over, the draft number is history and performance is everything. Well, not so, says diagnosis bias. How you frame something determines what you seek and how you process it. The ABCs, the apostrophe S of ABCs, the S is social biases. One is, and I'm mentioning just two or three as illustration, just to begin to listen for the specificity of how our unconscious operating system can work its operations involving money and finances, just so that you can reflect on it for yourself or listen for it in client. Affinity bias. We underestimate the risk of things that we like. We overestimate the risk of things we don't like foreign enemies or an out-of-favor investment. Here's a simple example. You lose $20 betting on a favorite in the Super Bowl. Well, that's unlucky. But you lose $2,000 betting that your alma mater will win the college game, even though they have the worst record in the conference. That's affinity bias. Loss aversion. Selling a loser investment admits defeat, and we tend to avoid pain. There's about twice as much bad feeling associated with losing $100 as there is a good feeling in gaining $100. And this is measured in the brain. Harry Markowitz won a Nobel Prize in economics for the mathematical breakthrough showing how to calculate a trade-off between risk and return in portfolio selection of stocks. He admitted, though, that he could not apply it to his own portfolio. And here's how he put it. I visualized my grief if the stock market went up and I wasn't in it, or if it went way down and I was completely in it. My intention was to minimize my future regret. So he decided not to invest in the stock market. So let's look at some of the most frequent mistakes made in writing a new money story. And again, like the roadmap, this can be of any story. Wellness, relationship, life story. But let's apply it here specifically to a new money story. One, not knowing that you don't know. How can you know that you don't know something? Because we believe we know, which can blind us to our ignorance. This, in turn, can cause us to be blind to signs that we may be mistaken. So to know, to ask, to question how we make decisions, not just what we make decisions about, but how we make decisions. There's a whole neuroscience of decision making that is the subject of a future seminar series and a book by one of my very favorite authors. Two, stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this may be a totally correct strategy, but it could also stop us from considering other right answers, other correct strategies that could be even more effective. So a way to look at this is to ask yourself, and then what? What else? Is there anything I'm not considering? What's a good time to stop thinking about deciding and act? There is an entire series of studies about optimal stopping time. Probably the best book about this is called Algorithms to Live By. And it's really a study of how do you know, like you're making a decision of, you know, getting an apartment, buying a house, hiring an assistant. How do you know when it's time to stop doing research and actually pull the trigger, make a decision, and go with it? There are ways to study that. There are things to consider that we just don't have time to go into that are an important aspect of decision making. But I just want to highlight the area of what one of the things we're listening for with our clients is how do they approach decision making? Do they even ask, or can we ask with them, not just what is your decision or what do you need to do, but how do you go about making a decision? Because people have different styles, different ways of going about decision making. So, and think about, this is a total sidebar, but it's a preview of coming attractions. Think about someone who is making an unprecedented decision, something that they have absolutely no experience, no prior experience in making decisions or even having the lived experiences to inform how to proceed. One of the areas, as an example, I see are people who deal with remarkable success and suddenly have to deal with, both by self-regulation and a whole spectrum of things, how to deal with fame, with power, with wealth. Think about the pro football player who goes from 0 to 60 million in 10 seconds. Unprecedented experience. There are a whole number. There's a future series that I'll be doing later this, I think it's going to be in the fall, called Breaking the Script, a Decision Neuroscience Coaching System. I think it's in September that we can go into that in more detail, because I think you will begin to see various things that your clients are needing to decide that they don't have the experience to base that on. And think about how intuition in instances with new and unprecedented situation can be misleading, because intuition is the automatic unconscious processing based on prior experiences that is instantly made in the left prefrontal cortex, the emotional midbrain, and left brain, without even thinking about it. But if it's based on old software or experiences that are nowhere to be seen in terms of experience, intuition may either fail or be misleading. So just something to think about. I'll introduce number three here of frequent mistakes with a brief quiz. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, though, created a system. They planned their strategy, decided even when they would jump off. So, how many were left? Well, five were left because they only planned and decided. They didn't commit to act. Number three is procrastination. Now, I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns. Putting off an exercise program, not paying yourself first, not saving for emergency, not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Most of our lives, we live as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. Yeah, we know the abstract notion of finiteness of time and about death, but we really have little sense of urgency. It can even contribute to a lack of focus. Here's an illustration. When a two-minute warning sounds in football, the team sometimes can achieve more in that final 2 minutes than they did in the previous 28. This imminent deadline, a limited, finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses concentration and increases effort. In our lives, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is an abstraction, something we acknowledge, but don't really have it internalized. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. 4. Inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key to success. This begins with knowing your strengths, your limitations, your biological cycles, when you perform best, your biorhythms, and creating a system, a map, for whatever you want to do. So it's important, I think, to know how to enter and exit various states of mind and which works best for a particular task. You know, an example, writing and editing, two different states of the mind, two different parts of the brain, to be done at separate times with their own entry and exit. Cluster activities that require the same state of mind. Many of you who have worked with ADHD clients know exactly what I'm talking about and the importance of doing this and creating this kind of structure of fundamental things. Identify what enhances your energy. Anticipation, creativity, pleasure, meditation, prayer. When you cluster activities that require the same state of mind, it becomes way more efficient. Identify what depletes your energy, such as toxic people or situations, negative mindset, lack of focus. 5, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what options are available and don't know what it would be like to pursue them, since you haven't done it before, this uncertainty can lead to a decision paralysis. And a different way of saying that, what may look like resistance in your client may simply be a lack of clarity about what the next step is. So people are more likely to change when new behavior is specific, clear, not vague or absent. Eating a healthy diet is vague and abstract. Eat healthy, save for the future. Where do you start with that? Those are good ideas, but not a plan. When you want to affect change, focus on the plan, the system. 6, too many choices. Some studies have shown how, at some point, choice debilitates rather than liberates, and someone can retreat to the default mode of not making a choice. And you've probably heard of this study. A classic study that began a whole process of looking at this more carefully was the decision paralysis study done at gourmet grocery stores. The research project offered a display of 6 different jams for tasting. On alternate weekends, there were 24 jams available for tasting. And for both of the weekends, the customers were given a coupon for $1 off if they purchased any jam. When the 24 jams were available, it attracted way more potential customers. But when 24 varieties were available for testing, 3% purchased. When only 6 varieties were available for tasting, 30% of the customers purchased jams. Too many choices resulted in a tenfold decline of actual purchases. With too many choices, we can get overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone, which is to do nothing. Decision paralysis. Another, lack of persistence. A truly engaging, courageous part of change may not be the initial decision or the initiation of a new order of things. It's the willingness to stay the course. A clearly defined goal can capture imagination and inspire passion. One extra degree of effort in business and in life can separate the good from the great. 51 publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He took it to number 52. 141 publishers turned down a guy who then decided to publish his book himself and sell it out of the back of his car. It had a really unlikely title for a book, which is part of why publishers rejected it, Chicken Soup for the Soul. And to date, Jack Canfield has sold 1.5 billion copies of his Chicken for the Soul series. So to get what you never had, you'll probably have to do what you've never done. Lord Eliot put it in a very simple way. Perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races, one after the other. So success is never final. Think about how you can, with the successful attainment of your client, look at how to sustain and even enhance that success. Because once they achieve that success, they may be for them in an uncharted territory, an unprecedented experience. So especially then, perhaps even more so, they're going to need you to help them navigate that success, to extend it, to make it even more encompassing, and to incorporate it as part of their identity. We're going to get to the final step in just a minute. Ross Perot put this very simply. Most people give up when they're about to achieve success. They quit on the one-yard line. 8 not following success trails. Have you said or heard some version of the following? Well, I want to change careers, but I don't know what I'd do instead. I want to play a bigger game, but I'm not sure what that is. Well, I want to create wealth, but I don't have a plan. So decide how you want to expand. Even pick success trails to follow. Watch someone who's doing what you might want to do. Ask them if you can take them to lunch or pick their brain or shadow them for a day to observe. Here's a simple example. When a very good friend of mine, I'll call Art. Well, that's his name. I'll call him Art. I'm just not really his last name. He was a very successful senior executive at IBM. He did an early retirement to form his own consulting firm. And he was immensely successful at doing this. People who had instant name recognition would pay significant money to pick his brain. When he learned that I was making my transition from psychiatry psychoanalysis to professional coaching, he flew to Houston to take me to dinner. And he said, Dave, here's what I'd recommend. Pick 5 very successful people who are doing something like you want to do, and take them to lunch or dinner and pick their brain. I'll count for the first. And he told me how he had done this with various people in the country when he made his transition, and it worked beautifully for him. So think about creating a support team, an advisory board, a networking group. Engage a mentor coach. Join a mastermind group. 9, believing it's unspiritual to make significant money. That can be a huge limiting assumption. There doesn't have to be a split between spirituality and money. There's nothing intrinsically unspiritual about money or wealth. It's one of those assumptions like starving artists. Why should someone of exceptional talent have difficulty converting that ability into significant income? Here are some synonyms: abundance, wealth, spirituality. Here are some antonyms: suffering, scarcity, non-spiritual. And remember, wealthy does not automatically equate with worldly riches. Rich and spiritual are synonyms. Think about how you want to create a plan, if that might include, if your style is to create a vision and repeat that vision. There's a chapter from a book that's in your resources about the new art and the old science, the neuroscience of creating a vision. And look at that and see one suggestion of a systematic way to create a visualization which will rewire your brain, and a systematic way to develop affirmations which will support that vision. The affirmations will help to revise mind software. So this can be useful to see yourself in a very successful business or help your client create a vision in a systematic way for something that they have not yet experienced. Because when you create a vision, when you repeat it over and over, it rewires your brain, so you're creating a future memory to kind of strategically back into. Now, one key is you don't make brain changes permanent unless you incorporate it into your story. Otherwise, it really doesn't register, or it may be extruded as noise. This is why 95% of people who diet gain back their weight. They don't reprogram their body image. So there are some simple elements here. Repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision must be renewed and repeated regularly so that they're etched. Be very specific about the experience of achieving the goal, the entire sensory experience, the visualization of exactly what it is to successfully arrive at your goal. And consciously incorporate this new vision into an ongoing story to be metabolized as part of your sense of self so that you don't lose this experience or the vision. Now, it's difficult to challenge. Here's the essence of the seventh step about programming new identity. Our identity is the most powerful force of our human psyche because it's the bedrock of our operating system of how and who we consider ourselves to be. So this is essential, I think, in working with a client. When they make a change, to celebrate that change by highlighting it and helping the client incorporate it as part of their identity, as part of how and who they are now, as this present operating system, this present identity. Because that transformation of their operating system and recognizing it is key to making it last, to making it permanent. That's what makes change last, is to repeat it, to etch it further, and at the same time to incorporate it as part of an identity of how and who someone is. And by talking about it at that level, about how they're doing, what they're doing, thinking about how you're going to highlight this transformation of what they're doing now versus before, that can help someone incorporate it themselves as part of their identity. And this is what we help our clients do, to reflect and have self-awareness, to have self-empathy, and to be able to monitor that process, including an affirmation of each positive step of recognition, experiencing it, incorporating that as part of an evolving model of how and who they are. So, and I think that's a really, really important part about what we do with clients. So some key elements are basically three: repetition, the neural networks dedicated to a vision, for example, need to be renewed and repeated. Be very specific about the experience of having achieved the goal, what it's like, how you experience getting there, and the specifics of what it is that is the successful goal achievement. And consciously incorporate this new vision into an ongoing story to be metabolized as part of the self. I'm repeating this because I think it's really important to look at how to incorporate that as part of how and who you are in present time. It's difficult to challenge long-held beliefs because they're a part of your identity. But a vision starts at the other end, the successful outcome. If someone has a fear of success or a fear of failure, this process of creating a vision of success bypasses both of those and etches the successful outcome. So to achieve a goal, program your automatic pilot for successful attainment of that goal, the affirmations to support the story of that achievement and pursuit. Affirmations are positive statements that state the goal as if it's already been achieved. They provide the context and support for visualization. Affirmations make a visualization a complete story. And there are some specific guidelines that you'll notice in the workbook. So to summarize here, affirmations reprogram your mind. Visualizations rewire your brain. Think about one aspect. Our possibilities are only limited by the ones we allow ourselves to see. Here's an example. Some of you have heard me talk about this story before. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was in prison, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity. Before the war, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had two 99s. Everything else was in triple digits. So to preserve his sanity, he decided to visualize playing golf every day. He would wake up, get dressed in his mind, all from the confines of a cell that had no sunlight for 23 hours. He decided his favorite course to go to, imagine driving there, getting out, warming up, smelled the trees, the grass, made each stroke with his entire body, walked to the ball. After he was released from his captivity, playing golf in his mind 7 days a week for 7 years, his first outing, he shot a 74. It's the power of a vision of mind over matters. So now we've looked at these seven steps, the roadmap process, the acronym of the roadmap for the seven steps. So we've examined your story with money as reality and metaphor, the path as well as the possession, and the power we give it, and to some aspects, its own power. So we've taken a journey over these four seminars to illuminate and to look at, for each of you, if you want to, how you want to change your money story. And these are the steps, just in brief overview. Recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines, decide what to change, map those changes, author new experiences, and program new identity. So in these seven steps, we've articulated some of the secret language of money, how some money issues are really about money, and how a bunch of other things, hitchhike on money, and how our money stories are a large part of our life stories. These basic steps deconstruct how you write your money story and how you live it. They're building blocks to revise a money story or to write a new one. So let's look now just in an overview at engineering effectiveness to review some of the essentials of engineering an effective new money story. One, make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are and where you're going. To be able, you've heard me say many times, to measure progress along the way and to tell what's detour and distraction. Two, make progress measurable. A specific destination, a tangible focus on the next step. Three, make progress visible, small, specific, attainable milestones that are specifically tangible and visible, with celebration of each small victory, because that helps to reprogram the unconscious operating system, also known as your identity. 4, specify the next step. Not abstract, not global, not vague. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. And remember, all you ever have to do is the next right thing. And a caveat for that is you may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. So this next right thing idea, this shrinks the change to an immediate, tangible step of effectiveness in order to experience momentum. One of the best examples of shrinking a task to a tangible next step is the 12-step program. Alcoholics Anonymous challenges its members one day at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. A small target leads to small victories. The cumulative experience, stepwise, of effectiveness and mastery. So we've just adopted the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test as we consider change. The scientific method is a challenge to create a mindset of inquiry can generate discomfort because that breaks the script. But it also catalyzes growth. Brain imaging studies have demonstrated where the sense of self resides in the brain. There's an actual anatomical location of the sense of self in our brains, the medial prefrontal cortex. This part of the brain lights up when people self-reflect and make assessments and judgments regarding themselves. A recent study found something really important. The more clearly and fully that you can picture your future self, the more money you'll save for the future. Emily Pronin did the prototype study at Princeton, did the prototype study to find that people who could actually envision themselves at an older age, 70s, 80s, early 90s, they saved almost three times as much in their for their retirement than people who did not or could not picture their future selves. This has been incorporated into some brain imaging studies, image enhancement studies out of Stanford to age progress what someone will look like now at 10-year intervals into the future if they, let's say, one program is if they keep smoking versus if they stop smoking, if they gain a pound a year or don't. And those who can picture themselves and have age-enhancing or age-adjusted progressions for future imaging end up saving more for the future when they can see an actual picture, an image of themselves age-progressed. So let's review some of the guidelines. Listen for the story that the source within you tells. Tell your story the way you want it to be in order to actualize it. To plan it, map it, and tell it is synonymous with its creation. Whatever you're living or experiencing in any way is the response to the story you're telling. If you want the story to change, you have to change the way you tell that story so it shifts your thinking and feeling as you're telling it. This means that responses from others are usually not in the equation of this creation. This new telling has to be in alignment with who you are, especially your needs and ideals, in order to have a complete energy field and full purposeful direction of that field going forward so that your strategies and goals align with your own needs and ideals, that all of you is going in the same direction. When you practice the story that resonates with who you really are, your full energy and power become activated. All of you is going in the same direction. When that occurs, know the direction you're going and the goal and strategies of that pathway. Make it tangible. Make it a map. Know that you can keep telling and living a better story no matter how good your story is now. The universe will resonate with and match your story as you live it. So here's a final story. For tens of thousands of years before books and computers, we transmitted our essence and principles by story. Story linked to the past, organized the present, and illuminated the future. Story showed us how to connect with each other's humanity in the paths crossed on the long journeys out of Africa to populate the rest of the world. Then the anatomy and physiology of our brains grew by putting thoughts and feelings into stories. Stories informed, instructed, inspired, governed, organized. Story is the most powerful way that we as humans communicate. Stories give birth to possibility. Stories are a way we resonate with our earlier selves, connect with others, and create a roadmap to proceed. Your story is yourself, your life, and what will survive you. At some point in the distant future, all that will be left of you, all that will survive you, is your story. Be sure to get it right. And here's a final quote. It's kind of a story quote, so hang in there. This may be the turning point your grandchildren will tell stories about years from now, the time you leapt over the abyss to the other side of the Great Divide and began your life in earnest. On the other hand, this moment of truth may end up being nothing more than a brief awakening when you glimpse what's possible on the other side of the Great Divide, but tell yourself, nah, that's way too far to jump. In that case, your grandchildren will have to be content talking about what delicious cookies you used to bake or what your favorite sports team was. It will all depend on how brave you'll be. We're in discussion mode now. I'm interested if you have thoughts, questions, things that you'd like to talk about a bit more.
Hi, David. This is Danny Bedoni. Thank you so much.
Hey, Danny. How are you?
Great. I've been enjoying every single one of them and done the work. And what my question for you and anyone that wants to pitch in is exactly how you finish. How do you become brave? Because that, if it's the money story, it all depends on how brave you will be.
Ah.
So where does one get the bravery? Because this applies to everything, money story, wellness, whatever it is.
Yes.
It's a system. But how do you create that braveness that you can do it or that our clients can do it?
Well, one way that I would think about that, since it has to be one step at a time, probably one of the couple or three most important things anyone has ever said to me was, we always make time for what's really important. So if it's important, you'll make time. If you're savvy, you'll create a system to make it real.
Thank
Does that
you.
Make sense to you?
Thank you. Yeah, and from that to making it real, that's where you become brave, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because that's a self-definition, too, of having your ideals and living into them. And remember, this is one of the things, and while you're holding down the fort in New York City, I know you've heard me say this before, Danny, and this is a quote from Toni Morrison. You guys are familiar with it, but I think it applies not just to parents, as she framed it initially, but it also should apply to us as mentor coaches both ways. When someone initiates contact with us and we initiate contact with that client, here's her question. To parents, when their kids walk in the room, do their eyes light up when they see you? Do our eyes light up when we take that call or that conference call with a client, do they with us? If it goes both ways, you're going to co-create something very special and meaningful that will make a major difference for the rest of their lives. So thanks for mentioning that. Anything else you want to add or ask Danny from your experience? I know you have tremendous successes and experiences that you could do many of these seminar series yourself.
No. Thank you, please. But culture, it depends on the bravery with the culture. And I see some people be a little bit more brave according when you have less to lose.
Well, what we know from how our brains work, anytime that any of us does something new or different, we're going to experience that with some kind of trepidation or uncertainty. Our brain's error detection mechanism is going to say, this is not what I expect. So that's immediately when it needs to be reframed as looking at the opportunity, at the challenge, rather than the discomfort, and mislabeling that, for example, as this is my gut telling me I've made a wrong decision, or my intuition is telling me, or simply to disengage, which will immediately create a return to a comfort zone. So that's the choice point. Each time we help a client take one step into a new and different experience that we need, I believe, to be appreciative and empathically aware of, this client at this moment with this step is experiencing something new and different. They haven't quite done or been that before. So it helps to appreciate that and to resonate with that experience with the client when it can further the experience and can frame an interpretation of it as a signpost of being in new territory, rather than I made a bad decision, I better go back, which would immediately end the discomfort, but not for the right reason. So that's part of brave, is both coach and client are hanging in there to take that step that is new and different, and then what do you do after that? You take the next step, and that framing can make a difference in terms of how it's perceived and processed. So thanks very
Thank
much,
you.
Danny. I hope this that was a great highlight and addition.
Thank you thanks so much. It's incredible.
Anyone else? Any other thoughts or questions or things to add or ask? Well, I appreciate, again, your kind words and the things that you've sent and the suggestion you've made. I hope that I've incorporated each of them and each of your questions or comments into a meaningful conversation to put it in context. So actually, I hate doing upsells, but this same time next week, I'll be starting a new series with CTA, a four-part series on the successful navigation of change and transition, mind, brain, and behavior strategies. And the a little bit of what we talked about in this seminar is kind of a précis for what we'll be talking much more about, because every client you work with will be going through some aspect of change and transition. So it's helpful to, I believe, to have an awareness of mind, brain, and behavior principles to facilitate that. So thank you all very much. If I can be of help to you in any way, fire me an email. I'll be eager to do that. Thank you again very, very much. It's been a privilege to work with you, and I appreciate
that. Yeah, I appreciate
it. Thanks very, very much. See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.